No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. Welcome. Tonight we're going to have a great discussion about lobbyists. First, let me welcome Maria. How are you, Maria? We've been apart for a while.
Yeah, that's right. Because you were in Portugal, and then It was Mother's Day. Thank you. I had the love of my sons and their significant others. My daughter she's a flight attendant, so she's low on the totem pole. So in general, any holidays, she's working it.
Yeah.
But I got to see her Monday, the next day. And it was just a love. I kept saying to my sons, it's not that it's Mother's Day that this is so special to me. It's that we get this rare opportunity to be together, because I know you have three kids. And with my four and everybody being adults and having their disparate lives and careers and geography and all that stuff, it's now the exception that the five of us are in the same room together. I mean, we did have Christmas together. So but here it is almost 6 months later. And so it was great. I really, really enjoyed my time with them. I always say to them, you know, unfortunately for you, I don't love you, just I like you. I like being around you, you know.
Well, and you know what I said on the show, Mother's Day show, that if it were up to me, there'd be at least a Mother's Week, if not a Mother's Month, because, you know, you're right. I have three children, but it's so much easier being a dad than it is being a mom. And where would any of us be without our moms? You know, I unfortunately only had my mom for 15 years. But,
I know, that's so tragic.
Cool. But you know, not a day goes by that I don't think about her, and that she doesn't impact my life somehow. You know, moms are. I was blessed with a great mom and a great sister and a great grandmother. So you know, we can't say enough good things about mothers. But while we're on the subject of good things, let me just add, as we start the show, that last week was a somewhat amazing week for our cause of statehood, in that we got two United States senators to sign on to our statehood bill, and we haven't had a senator sign on since February. We actually had two in February, Kamala Harris from California and Patrick Leahy from Vermont. But last week we got Mazie Hirono from Hawaii, Democrat from Hawaii, and Martin Heinrich, Democrat from New Mexico. So thank you, Senator Hirono and Senator Heinrich. We appreciate your support, and we're now up to 24, which is the most we've ever had on a statehood bill. So
congratulations.
Well, thanks.
It continues to fall along party lines, correct?
Yes, it does. But, you know, we met with three Republican offices, and a fourth, Orrin Hatch, refused to meet with us. But the other three met with us. And so we're ever hopeful to get a Republican soon. And this has to be a bipartisan thing. It's not going to happen if it's only Democrats. And I'm not sure the Democrats realize that, but, you know, we need some Republicans on the bill, and I think we'll get them. I really do.
Well, I had a very long conversation with our former congressional member who is retired, and he was telling me they just had a ribbon cutting and an opening earlier this month for his papers and the reconstruction of his office from Capitol Hill. And it was quite the ceremony, and Condoleezza Rice was the keynote speaker.
Wow.
And there were Democrat elected officials in attendance. He's a Republican. Elton Gallagher is his name. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that one of his best friends was Stan Berman, and that they, the new, I think he said it was the New York Times or the Washington Post, followed the two of them for like 6 months and couldn't figure out how they could have a friendship when they were on both different sides. And they said what you and I always say, Michael, is that we agree on about like 85% of the topics. It's, you know, yes, we are in different parties and we represent different constituents. He even told me a story about John Boehner calling him in because he was helping Stan get reelected. And Boehner's like, he's a Democrat. And he goes, yeah, but he gets things done. He goes, exactly. Why do we want a Democrat to get things done? He goes, because that's what the beauty of what we stand for is getting things done. So I was just entertained by his recollections. I didn't know this part about him. So I do have faith and hope that you will start to get bipartisan attraction.
Yeah. And you know what? It's a sad thing, Maria, that we don't see as much of that anymore, but there, you know, there are storied relationships, Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy, John McCain and Ted Kennedy. You know, there were a lot of people that Bob Dole had several Democrats who admired him, and including myself. I've got to tell you that as we talk about tonight's subject, we'll talk about this. But when I was a college student, I covered PL 480, which is the farm bill, and Bob Dole was the only guy that came to every single hearing. I so admired him, even though I didn't agree with him very often. And he had a great sense of humor, and there were many Democrats on Capitol Hill that respected him. And I think, you know, if I put my thinking cap on, I'm getting old, but I could probably think of some more examples. But there were plenty of people that on both sides of the aisle.
The infamous one, Tip O'Neill.
Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill was a character. He was really a
but across the aisle kind of a guy.
Yeah, he could. Yes, he was. And I think Lyndon Johnson was also when he was represented Texas on the Hill. He was someone who was known as crossing, you know, being able to get people to cross the aisle. We've just become so partisan lately. Now, you know, I'm no expert on the history of Congress. I don't know whether this is cyclical or it's happened before, but it seems to me that in the 40 years that I've been involved, I've never seen this sort of partisanship. And it's troubling because, you know, we need to get things done for America. We have some serious problems. I just came back from Portugal, if I can digress a little bit.
I would love you to.
And there were 70 countries there. And number one, you know, we all agreed, I think, that there were problems that were so big that none of us, no country, by us I mean a country, no country could deal independently with them, like global climate change. You know, the people in South Africa are running out of water. They're limited to a couple of gallons a day. Where problems like that, we have to come together and work together. So I think we could think of a dozen examples in the United States as well, like healthcare and the environment. That was one thing. And another thing is I got to talk about the American dream. That was my particular plenary session. It was really well attended. And it was great to do that because I got to talk about DC statehood as part of the American dream, because the American dream includes equality. So I not only got to talk about an issue that I care about, but also a bigger, more important issue in some ways, the American dream. And, you know, I think of myself as a good example of the American dream because I was orphaned at 15. I dropped out of high school. I got a second chance. I ended up with a master's degree, starting my own business, getting elected, you know, and I don't know any other country where that would have been the case. So the good news that came out of the conference is that everybody across the world still looks to us, as Ronald Reagan said, as the shining light on the hill, sending out a beacon to the world of hope. And you know, that's the good news.
For the listeners who might not have listened to either last week's broadcast or the one prior where you talked about what you were going to be doing, do you want to bring them up to speed on that, why you were in Portugal and why you were one of 70 countries?
There's a group called Horusis, and Horusis is a Greek word meaning vision. And what they do is they try to bring politicians and business people together, and they have all sorts of seminars, and it's 4 or 5 days of everybody getting together and talking and listening to each other. The beauty of it is that I met more people that wanted to listen than to wait to talk, which is what we do in Washington. You know, we don't listen always. We spend more time waiting for our turn to say what we have to say. But at this particular event, it was just so beautifully handled and so well executed that everything was taken care of. It was a relaxing environment. They fed you morning, noon, and night. There was entertainment. There was, you know, the seminars went off like clockwork. So I went because I was invited, and I was intrigued at the idea of speaking about the American dream. I knew that I could talk about statehood, and it was important to get statehood on the international stage. I think it's important because we try to export democracy to the world. The world should know that the people in the capital don't have it. So that was my motivation. And I not only got to do an hour plenary session in the main auditorium, they only do one of these a day, and I got to do one.
Nice.
And it was well attended with a Republican co-host. And that was the only downside. You want to know that people were angry, I think, in the audience. Some of the people were angry that me and the Republican didn't fight more.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, and at one point I said, I'm sorry, I'm really trying to think of horrible things to say about this guy, except I like him. Mm-hmm. And everybody laughed because you could see that there were a certain amount of people that, you know, wanted to see us mix it up. But
how great that you didn't, that you showed that you might have differences of political orientation, yes, but you could still be respectful and get along.
And we approached the idea differently, and we had different things to say. But in the bottom line was, we're both proud Americans. We both love our country, you know. And this is what I do. I've said this before on the show. When I interact with somebody, regardless of what their political beliefs are or their political persuasion, the first thing I try to do is find something about them to connect with, to respect. And this man was a graduate of the Naval Academy, a former Marine. And, you know, I respect that. I respect anybody that has stood up for their country and stood up for me and my wife and children. So that's how I approach, you know, dealing with him, was that I started from a point of respect. And I think if we just did that more, if we stop looking at what separates us and look at what connects us, we'd be so much better off. You know, next week we'll talk about this a little bit, but a week from Monday, I will ride to the wall on my Harley Davidson to pay homage to all the men and women who have stood up for America. We do this every year through a thing called Rolling Thunder. You've probably heard about it.
Yes.
It's the biggest motorcycle event with the exception of Sturgis.
And how many bikes are involved usually?
Well, you know, the hundreds of thousands. I mean,
wow.
It's just amazing. I used to go to the Pentagon. Now I ride in with another group, but I used to ride in with the main group in the Pentagon, and they would start. And when you started your motorcycle, it took you 3 or 4 hours just to get out of the Pentagon because there were so many. The entire parking lots, all like 9 parking lots, were covered with motorcycles.
Yeah, that is the problem. the density. I mean, when I was in Sturgis, to go through Sturgis, you literally are walking your bike,
right?
Because there's a stop sign almost at every block, and because there's so many bikes, I remember just walking most of the time. Then when you get out of town, you go on those rides to Mount Rushmore and the Devil's Tower and all that stuff that's gorgeous. But yeah, I wouldn't do that anymore either.
you know what? It's really uplifting to go and see this. But the saddest part of it is that there's so many Vietnam veterans, and all they want is for somebody to say thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for standing up. Thank you. Thank you for putting your life on the line for what you believed in and for America. And, you know, I was somebody that didn't believe in the war in Vietnam, but I believe in every veteran that's ever put on a uniform. I don't care if they did it in a popular war or an unpopular war. They did it for me,
exactly.
And they did it for America. And it bothers me that I go down there with as one of the few politicians. And I'll tell you what, on that day, I get hugged by more people than I do the rest of the year. They're so grateful just to have somebody come and say, thanks. I appreciate it.
I cannot believe that is still anytime I hear anybody mention their service to our country, I always stop and say, thank you for your sacrifices. And like you said, so many of them are taken aback that I guess they haven't ever heard it. So maybe you're right.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, no, you sacrificed everything for me.
Right. And the Vietnam guys haven't heard it, or they haven't heard it enough. And, you know, that's why they write to the Vietnam Memorial. But and anybody that's had military people in their family understand that's not only sacrifice for the service member, it's a sacrifice for their whole family.
Absolutely.
My sister-in-law got jerked all over the world. You know, my brother was stationed in 7 or 8 different places. His kids grew up in some fabulous places, but you know, they grew up in Alabama and Colorado and England, and you know, and every day he was in the cockpit of an F-111, we worried about him. You know, several of those planes crashed, and he lost dear friends, and yeah, it's not only the service man themselves, but the mothers, the sisters, the brothers, the children, wives,
the husbands, because there's women serving now.
Yes.
And the deployments, that sacrifice, yes, of having, yes, an absentee partner, spouse, father, mother. There's several stories here where babies have been born while they've been deployed, and they're, you know, Skyping in so they can be a part of this.
And you know, my sister-in-law was a hairdresser. She was a really good hairdresser, but she never had a career as a hairdresser because she moved from place to place. She delivered newspapers. She was the night manager. Let me tell you, we should have her on the show sometime. She was a night manager at the Denny's on the highway. She has some stories, boy. You would she would make you laugh until you cried. you know, she did all sorts of crazy things to make ends meet because, you know, military people aren't paid a lot of money,
right?
And you know, yeah, and she could have made a great living as a hairdresser, but you know,
she couldn't establish a clientele because she was always moving,
right?
Always right.
Moving.
So bringing us to our topic today, which is about lobbyists and lobbying, because it was in the news late this week about there are several that have benefited from having their association with President Trump and Vice President Spence, which is not ear-shattering or historic, if you will. But because you are in D.C. and you see these people and you know these people, I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to understand, first of all, what is a lobbyist and why was it established? And then, because I know there's been a lot of different legislation dating since 1946 up until the present day, trying to curtail it or make it legitimize or what have you. So let's just go with lobby. Why is there such a thing as lobbying?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated issue. But basically, you know, you need lobbyists, right? Because it's come to mean somebody that tries to persuade members of Congress, but they also inform members of Congress. Just imagine if you were elected, excuse me, to Congress, and you're a doctor or a lawyer or you know, a psychologist, and you have to deal with something like the one of the things that I covered was the breakup of the phone company. It's very, very complicated. Those are very, very complicated issues, and you need experts to inform you. I mean, what the hell do you know about telecommunications if you're a doctor? Or what do you know about telecommunications if you're a lawyer? And maybe you were a personal injury lawyer. Who knows? So these people are there to inform you, but they also, their main job is to persuade you. And you have to be careful of the information they provide because it's generally biased information. So
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the word itself, lobby, is a verb, which is an action word, which is to seek influence. So information is not listed in any of the, when I was drilling down into, you know, where is the origin and why was it seemed to be needed or whatever. And because these, when you say inform, but because it's about influencing, that means that everything they say you have to take with a grain of salt.
Absolutely.
Because they stand to gain for you doing what they want you to do.
Exactly. And they're only going to paint part of the picture. And that's why democracy works better than most other forms of government, any other form of government, because it pits, you know, it's competitive. So you have lobbyists on both sides of the fence, and you've got to listen. The only way you get the whole picture. You and I have talked about this before, that, you know, I tell you that I listen to MSNBC and CNN and Fox News, you know, because I believe the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Well, that's true, very true of lobbying. You know, if you're considering gun legislation, you must not only listen to the NRA, you must listen to the Coalition to Stop Handgun Violence and, you know, the other, the Brady Foundation and the people on that are on both sides of the issue, because that's the only way you're going to get the real picture. And, you know,
So there are salespeople at the end of the day.
There are salespeople at the end of the day. More than anything, there are salespeople. Now, that's generally what lobbyists do. But there are also lobbyists like me that lobby for a cause. And we're salespeople too, really. We're selling an idea. But, you know, we're not in it, you know, we're not in it ostensibly for the money or the business or the power. We're in it for, you know, for some sort of common good. And there are all sorts of welfare groups and other groups that you know of. I would say the NAACP has a lobbying arm and you know.
NGOs and 501c3s and nonprofits also lobby?
No, they're not allowed to. And that's
okay.
That's where they draw the line. If you do lobby, you can't be a 501c3. And that really is a really, really, it's not a fine line. It's a very, very distinctive line. You're not allowed to lobby. So what organizations, 501c3s, do is they create another organization, which is the lobbying arm of their organization. So
not under the umbrella, but like a separate foundation or something, or a LLC,
a separate entity, usually called something like the Committee for Political Education, which does in fact lobby, but no, is under their umbrella, but they keep the activities of the two groups separate. Because if they don't, they run into trouble with the IRS. And, you know, you're not allowed to lobby and you're not allowed to have business activity if you're a 501c3. So, for example, a great example from California, the guy that had the Crystal Cathedral, mm-hmm. I can't remember what his, Shuler, was that
yes.
his? Reverend
yes.
Shuler. He almost lost his 501c3 status because he opened a Ticketron outlet in the cathedral, and the IRS almost revoked his 501c3 status as a religious group. All religious groups are exempt from
now
tax.
I understand that it's quite or can be quite lucrative to be a lobbyist.
Oh my God, yeah. Some of them are multimillionaires from lobbying.
And that's because they're persuasive and effective. Is that how they get
you would think, you know.
Or is it they lend their prestige and their station in life to the cause?
Both of those things. So, for example, it's very common for a full bird colonel to retire. You know, you can retire from the military. You know, a colonel could have 25 years in, and if he started when he was 21, you know, if he had 30 years in, he'd be about 50 when he retired, and then to go to work for a defense contractor. So actually lobbying the people that he worked with. You know, it'd be like, you know, if you and I worked together and all of a sudden I retired and became a lobbyist and you're the person with the money and I start coming over and saying, hey, Maria, remember me? Come on, man. We need some of your business. So that's very common. And in fact, there are laws, if you're an elected official, where you can't lobby the body of which you were a part for a certain number of years.
Oh, so it's like a non-compete.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
my first career, Michael, I was one of the first women that State Farm Insurance appointed as an agent, because until my time, they were always only men. And I got into the business early, right out of college. And the people would come and want to take me to lunch who represented glass companies for, say, replacement of the windshields on the cars, or replacement of the windows in their homes, or auto body shops and stuff like that. And I always found it odd because I knew why they were there. Like they were, you know, they would give me their car and they say, could they take me to lunch? And I felt dirty that I could like start referring to them because I got lunch out of the deal. I never really understood it. I wanted to deal with people that had integrity, and I'm not saying that these folks didn't, but would a meal be enough to, you know, they used to drop off trinkets and notepads and water bottles, you know, stuff that would have their emblem on it or that sort of thing. And that's why I don't get why, but it obviously works. Or else people wouldn't keep doing it.
It goes a lot deeper than that. I mean, you know, that's kind of basic PR. In fact, my brother, the who went into the Air Force and became a pilot, his first job out of college for a few months was with Park Davis as a detail man. And what detail men do is they do exactly what you're talking about, except they go to doctor's offices.
Right.
And leave off samples, and they leave off paperweights shaped like kidneys, and they give them, you know, free little tchotchkes.
And they flirt.
Right. And they give, yes. I mean, look, it's not a coincidence that a lot of people that do this kind of work at that level are attractive young women, you know, or handsome young guys. That's not a coincidence. But at the congressional level, it goes a lot deeper than that. And that is, you know, they take them to lunch and they, but it's what they say at lunch that's important. You know, a lot of these people, look, if you want to make politics better in America, get the money out of it. Get that. There's just millions and millions and millions of dollars pumped into it. And let me tell you, a company like AT&T used to put tens of millions of dollars through their political action committee into politics every year. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that nobody's putting $50 million into politics if they're not getting more than $50 million out of it. And that's the thing. The government has trillions of dollars to spend, and people want a piece of the pie, and that's one way they influence. Another way they influence is with people. So if you're a labor union, for example, you lobby Congress and you say, I'm a Teamster and I represent 1.6 million Teamsters. So I want you to do what I want you to do because there's 1.6 million votes involved. But corporate lobbyists lobby with money. And you're right, Maria, it is, I mean, sleazy may not be the right word for it. I don't know what the right word for it is, but it's certainly torrid, and it shouldn't be part of the American process, in my opinion. You know, when we do little things to try to mitigate it, of course, politicians policing themselves is always dubious. But in New Hampshire, for example, we're up in New Hampshire lobbying. We're lobbying the New Hampshire legislature to support a resolution in support of voting rights for the District of Columbia. And when you go into the capital in New Hampshire, lobbyists have to wear these gigantic tags around their neck that say lobbyist, so everybody knows who they are. You can't just walk in a suit and tie. You have to wear this thing that says lobbyist. And, of course, in Washington, you have to register as a lobbyist.
Well, that point, though, when I was doing some research on this, so in 1946, the Federal Regulation of Lobbying Act requires registration if 50% of your time was spent lobbying.
Right.
Then in 1991, it was discovered that 10,000 of the 13,500 weren't registered.
Right.
Then Clinton signed into law in 1995 that if 20% of your time was spent lobbying, you have to register. And then we have that Jack Abramoff, is that how you say his name?
Yeah,
Abramoff. Debacle.
Yes.
So apparently none of this is, well, I shouldn't say that. Apparently it's easy to get around it. Or to skirt by it, or to
always, you know, there's always loopholes, right? And I'll give you a great example. There's a thing called the Federal Election Commission, which regulates how much money you can put into politics. There's a maximum that you can only put. I don't know what it is today, but when I was at the DNC, it was $40,000. You can't give more than $40,000 to the Republicans and the Democrats combined. So as an individual. So one day, Ray Kroc's wife is driving somewhere, and she hears Ronald Reagan say something she doesn't like. So she sends $1 million check to the Democratic National Committee.
Wow.
Yeah. I get the check. Now, we get checks like this all the time, which are phony, You know, there somebody will take a closed checking account and they'll write, $1 billion to pay off the national debt, signed Abraham Lincoln, you know. but we get this, and it's FedEx, and it's from Mrs. Ray Kroc, and I recognize the name, you know. She, as our listeners probably know, her husband started McDonald's. And so I take it to my boss. What do we do with this? Well, guess what? We put $40,000 into our federal account, and we took the other $960,000 and put it into state education, a state education fund for the Democrats, because the Federal Election Commission doesn't control state elections. So there's always a way. We can always figure out a way to do it, you know.
To be, and that's creative.
You're right, and that's what we say in politics. Never give back the money. We'll figure out a way to deal with it.
Don't, even if that wasn't the intention of the donor?
Well, if the donor made their intention clear, then you wouldn't be able to do that. If the donor had written on the check for federal elections, then we would have had to return the $960,000.
I see.
Yeah.
And the reason I asked that is when I was with the American Red Cross doing development, it was always about donor intent. So if they were donating to a specific disaster, you remember they got a little bit in trouble with the Haiti thing.
Right.
Because the point, when the American Red Cross responds to a disaster, they're spending money that has been donated. But then that disaster generates awareness, and so people will then donate to that disaster. But the truth is that they should really be paying it forward, because it's about the next disaster too.
Right.
But if they say specifically to Hurricane Maria, for example, then the American Red Cross has to put it into that fund, and they can't use it forward. But so that's why I was curious about the intention of the donor.
Well, and that's true in politics too. But very often, money is given in a way. I've got a really funny story for you, It's true in politics too, but they usually find a way around it. But this, when I was at the DNC, the Democrats decided they were going to do a nationwide telethon, you know, just like Jerry Lewis, to raise money for the Democratic Party. They did it with a group that had done it for organizations like the Red Cross and children's groups. And Daniel J. Trevante was the host of this thing. I don't know if you remember him. He was the captain on Hill Street Blues.
Okay. I was going to say, name's not familiar, but yeah. because I'm not a TV person.
And one funny thing, I hate to digress here, but I was in Utah at the main phone bank. For some reason, phone banks are the really, really big ones are located in that part of the country, I guess.
Really?
Centrally located, yeah. So I'm at this phone bank with state of the art. They've got like 400 operators. And when Jane Fonda came on the telethon, so many people called in that they burned out some of the phone lines.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And they didn't call in to give money. They called in because they were angry. Veterans were angry with her.
Oh.
Vietnam. She'd gone to North Vietnam. I don't know if you remember.
Yes, I do. Hannah Jane.
But they were so bright. They were so mad at her. But anyway, that is an interesting thing, because in order to get the millions of dollars we needed up front to do the telethon, we had many big donors sign loan guarantees for $40,000, which was the maximum, right? So we had hundreds of big donors sign these loan guarantees to guarantee the money to the people that produced the show. And then the telethon didn't raise enough money to cover its costs. So it took us, I don't know, a couple of years maybe to pay it off, a year or two to pay it off. And during that time, the Republicans went to the FEC and they said a loan guarantee is the same as a contribution and therefore all these people are barred from giving any more money to the Democratic Party.
Oh,
and
my.
They were. For years, we couldn't get money out of our biggest donors because we had made that mistake. And so, you know, and to quote my friend Will Shakespeare, we were hoisted on our own petard. It was an idea that just didn't work, and it froze the capital. So it compounded the fact that we had this serious debt, and also we couldn't pay it off, and those people couldn't contribute any money to us because they had guaranteed the loans.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's complicated, right?
Yeah,
and you know what? The problem, I know we don't use that word anymore. The challenge is that we don't foresee that until it's happened,
right.
And then we have to go back and sweep up our side of the street to take care of that. And as an aside, that I have that big issue with artificial intelligence, because the what do they call it? I guess the EU is on May 25th adopting something called the GDPR, which is their governance on artificial intelligence. And it's an overarching thing about our data and how it can be used. And it doesn't matter what country the company is in. It's a global thing and all of this stuff. And we here in the United States don't have anything like that. No common agreement, no code of ethics, no code of honor. And I'm really worried that something egregious is going to happen, like the Cambridge Analytica thing, Cambrian, and that after the fact, we're going to try to close and take care of things. It's going to be too late.
Well, you know, how often does that happen? And you know, because
people say, well, we can't foresee that. But if other parts of the world are foreseeing that, then why aren't we putting some skin in that game?
I mean, well, and I got to tell you, to get back to Portugal quickly, the Horaces thing, that's what I see as the great potential of things like that, that they bring people together to share ideas so that maybe we can learn from each other. You know, the New York Times calls Horaces the Junior League of International Relations, you know, like they're well-meaning people that really don't solve any problems. But you know what? The coming together is in itself an important part of the problem solving.
Well, to at least have the conversation.
Yes.
With the agents that are involved, i.e. our world.
Yeah.
How can it be bad?
Exactly.
And does it have any efficacy in terms of consensus that gets implemented, or it's just like a think tank?
Well, I don't know that. No, they don't come up with like a set of
resolutions or something.
Or resolutions at the end. No, it's just about coming together, you know, and sharing ideas in a really social atmosphere where they do things like you share meals together and you know, there are things on international banking and how to invest billions of dollars in third world countries and things like that. But there's also they bring experts on around the world on how to be happy. I went to a thing with five experts on how to be happy, and it was amazing. One of the things that I learned was happiness isn't something that happens to you. Happiness is something that you plan for and you make happen. You know, and I think that was a revelation to me, because we always think, you know, this will make me happy, or that'll make me happy. And their approach was, it's much more fundamental than that. Or there was one on architecture and how to make architecture speak to world problems and facilitate cooperation, which was also very interesting, that they had these leading architects from around the world talking about how they plan buildings and integrate green space to make a more relaxing atmosphere and use light to make people more upbeat and positive, and how they plan meeting spaces to bring people together rather than just fit them into a room, see how many people they can fit into a room. It was really, really interesting. And you know, I think all those things, help. They help you understand where other people come from. Because let me tell you something. Not everybody thinks the way we think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a mistake we make. We assume the whole world feels the same way we do about things.
And that's because we're an individualistic culture, and a lot of the world is more of a collectivist culture.
Yeah.
And so you're exactly right. Individualistic societies are I-based, and collective societies are we-based.
Yes.
And so there, that juxtaposition there, it's not yin and yang. It's, you're right, it's totally different orientations. Even in the field of psychology, when they made that a part of the program, it's because if you're dealing with another culture and they're not looking you in the eye, it's not rude. It's their culture. It's considered aggressive if you engage somebody in the eye, or even touching somebody in terms of a handshake or a hug. And you have to be sensitive to that, because we're not like everybody else.
Right.
I mean, as successful as we are, our individualistic culture created the America that we know today and the world leader. But those other societies have a lot to offer, too. And one of them is peace of mind and health and well-being.
Well, and you know what? I remember very distinctly being in graduate school and having a professor from the Soviet Union who was a visiting professor. And we started talking about freedom of the press. And, you know, of course, this is freedom of the press is the First Amendment to the Constitution. It really is a value that most Americans hold dear. But he was outraged. I mean, he stunned all of us, and he was outraged. And I remember him saying, "What right do you have as a single individual to criticize the government, which is a collective of all the people? What right does one person have to criticize all the people? All the people always know better than any individual." And of course, we were all stunned by that. We were like, what? You know, mm-hmm. because it's so important to us. So, yeah, there are a lot of interesting ways to face problems and you know, if I had to leave my children with one piece of advice, I think maybe the most important thing I've ever learned in life, or at least one of the top three or four, is what Albert Einstein said, that what you see depends on where you stand, right? Everything is relative to the position that you're in. So the only way you can learn, really, is to take on a different position, to see things from a different angle. So, again, back to lobbying, that's what lobbyists try to do, I think, is try to show you things from their perspective. But you absolutely have to be careful, because their perspective is certainly
biased,
yes.
So that would be like, I couldn't do that. I couldn't be a gun for hire unless I believed in the cause. Like with my degree, when I get my PhD in media psychology, the tools I'm learning about communication and people and technology and artificial intelligence and augmented reality and all of that, I wouldn't put that to use with Monsanto, for example.
Right.
Or Putin, for example. But this sounds so naive. There are people who do anything for a price.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and they say it's their job. And, you know, that's, I can't tell you how many times I've said to people, calling it your job doesn't make it right. You know, the job of a drug dealer is to sell drugs to children. The job of a hitman is to kill people. You know, calling it your job doesn't make it right. And some people feel like, hey, look, if somebody's paying me, and believe me, these guys, a lot of them are hired guns. If you want to see the cynical side of lobbying, you should go watch the movie Thank You for Not Smoking. I don't know if you've ever, have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah, it stars Bill Macy. And
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, he's one guy works for the NRA, one guy works for the tobacco industry. They're all lobbyists. There's three lobbyists that are friends. And I forget who the third person is. But, you know, at one point, Bill Macy, I think, is the tobacco lobbyist, and he laughs at the NRA guy. He goes, how many people are killed with guns? He goes, and the guy says, I don't know, 3,000 a year. And he goes, that's nothing. We lose 4 million to cigarettes every year. You know, I mean, it's like my product is, you know,
more lethal than yours.
more lethal, so my job's harder. You know, and it really is. It's really it now, you know, I don't know that it represents reality, but it certainly represents, gives you a picture of how bad lobbying can be. But then there's good lobbyists too. You know, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers were lobbyists, right? And look at the laws we have today. Look at what these handful of moms did to change America. And, you know, when we're talking about guns again, these kids that have come forth after Stonewall Douglas, maybe they'll be great lobbyists that'll change the way America thinks about certain things when it comes to guns. So
would you consider then the Black Lives Matter movement a lobbying arm of sorts?
Well, I mean, I think that's, no pun intended, kind of a gray area. You know, that's a movement. I think that like the civil rights movement, I wouldn't have called Dr. King a lobbyist, but the NAACP I certainly would call lobbyists. I wouldn't have called SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Organizing Committee, I wouldn't call them lobbyists, but I certainly would call the congressional, well, the Congressional Black Caucus, or congressmen actually, but or members of Congress. But you know, that's kind of a gray area. I think maybe the end result is the same, but the tactics are different.
So going back to the beginning of our conversation, when you said lobbying was about informing, and I'm saying it's about influencing, why isn't it up to the elected official to gather their own information with the staff that they have so that they can get it unbiased and nonpartisan? Why do they need to be spoon-fed by paid shucksters?
Well, first of all, let me say that your definition of the term is much more accurate than mine. I'm saying that, you know, this is the guise is that it's information, but yeah, it really is all about influence. Let me make that very clear. And certainly that was the intent of Congress. The first act of Congress was to create the Library of Congress. And, you know, the Library of Congress has specific librarians. So if you want to know about breast cancer, there's a breast cancer librarian. In fact, there's probably a whole staff of breast cancer librarians that deal with different aspects of breast cancer. So somebody on the health committee is considering a health bill and they want information on a specific area of cancer, breast cancer, liver cancer, whatever, there's probably a librarian that's assigned to them that can give them the information they need. But the cutting edge information and the information that the librarian is getting very often comes from places like the AMA and comes from drug trials and comes from other, you know, comes from corporate sources. So I think they do try to get much of the information they can in an unbiased way, but we leave the door open for people to come in and influence legislation by providing their own information. And maybe we shouldn't.
Well, because I'm thinking what you mentioned about the library with my PhD program, because I'm a student at this university, I go into this portal where they have access to the latest research as well as all research on specific topics. So I would assume that elected officials could get into the portal of the Library of Congress. And it's like Googling, if you will. There's Google Scholar, too, which has, but this is in academia. So I would think that you would have nothing but resources to get your own information and not take the time from somebody who's paid to influence.
Well, you probably do. But as a politician, if you don't get elected, and I'm telling you this from my heart because I'm running for re-election, if you don't get elected, You don't get to do anything. So when the guy from the Teamsters knocks on the door and says, hey, Maria, I'm here with my 1.5 million votes, and I know you want to run for president. Can we have lunch? You say, yes, we can have lunch.
Right.
You know, and therein lies the rub. If maybe we should get rid of lobbyists, but I don't know how we would do it. Maria, we've run out of time.
Again.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your personal expertise with the subject, because I find it fascinating. And I, again, until I started doing some research, I had no idea about it, just that I've heard the word.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think a lot of people don't know about it. But here in Washington, we certainly, that's what they call K Street, is Lobby Alley. You know, it's just filled with lobbyists from one end to the other. So thanks again for listening, America. We're going to leave you with a song from Warren Zevon, Send Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
In that order.
In that order.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their